I just thought about this. I probably should have handed those out later. Probably not a wise idea to hand out rocks before I get up here to talk. But just kind of set that to the side. If you got one, if you didn't, don't worry. You can write on your hand or a piece of paper or whatever. It'll be fine later on. So we're going to get to that in just a minute. Not too much stuff here. Our topic tonight, we're going to look at the anointing of David. If you wanted to title the courage and faith of David, we're also going to kind of go through a pretty wide time period there to get to Goliath also, the giant. And I know that's what everybody's waiting on, but you're going to have to work through the background first. First off, is there a better character? Like if you had to teach Vacation Bible School and they said, do you want to teach? Well, the first question is, what about David? Seems like that's a gift right there to you. Just teach about David. There's a lot of stuff about David. If you're going to make your lesson, you kind of got to cut it down and cut it down and cut it down. And then when you finally get within your parameters of time, you feel like you've left out half of the good stuff. So if I leave out your favorite part tonight, please raise your hand, whatever you need to do. Tell us your favorite part of the story, because I don't want to leave any of the good stuff out. But we'll start with a little background. In 1 Samuel 16, up to this point, David is not mentioned up until chapter 16 in 1 Samuel. Most of the attention was on who? Saul. Saul was a king. If you know your background there, God tried to warn him. He said, you don't want a king? People said they do. Well, they got Saul. Saul's been the king, started out pretty good, and it quickly soured. And that's about where we are. Things have soured for Saul. David is now going to be introduced to us. And in verse 1, it begins with God telling Samuel, he says, fill your horn with oil. Go, I will send you to Jesse, the Bethlehemite, for I have selected a king for myself among his sons. First thing when I read that is, who else could God have sent Samuel to? He doesn't send him to the army. He could find a soldier there, right? A general, hero, somebody that's battle-hardened, you know, that everybody kind of expects. This guy is going to be our leader, our next king. He doesn't send him there. He could have sent him over to the schools of the prophets. Could have got an educated man, right? Someone who knew about this sort of stuff. He doesn't go there. Where does he send him? What was Jesse's and his family's, what was their occupation? They were shepherds. They're farmers. That should tell us something. Why would he choose a farmer or a shepherd over all these other people who, when we look at it from the outside, these people are obviously more qualified to rule or to lead? But instead, he goes with a farmer. Can you imagine Samuel when he hears this? Samuel's probably a little, okay, I guess, maybe. We'll go see what it's about. And that's exactly what he does. In verse 3, he tells him, he says, you shall invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do, and you shall anoint for me the one whom I will designate to you. Now this sacrifice, there was a little bit of a background behind that too. How did Samuel even wind up going to see Jesse? Or what were the things that were happening around that? Do y'all remember? Was he excited to go? He was afraid. Who was he afraid of? Saul. This would end bad. Saul, we know at this point, is we said it's soured. Samuel's already gotten on to him for the things that he's done. And now you want me to go behind his back and go anoint someone else? Not a warrior, not a smart guy that could get me out of this, but a farmer. You want me to go to a shepherd? and I'm going to choose one of his sons. So he's a little worried, but God tells him, no, you take a heifer, you go, you're going to have a sacrifice, and find Jesse and tell him to bring his sons in. And from there, I will let you know who or what I want you to do. So probably not the normal chain of events that Samuel would be used to. But also we have to remember, how many kings of Israel have there been up to this point? How many people have been anointed? One. So nobody really knows what's going on. How is anointing a new king supposed to look? We don't really have a base. We haven't done it a bunch of times, just once. And who did we pick? We picked a guy who was a head taller than everybody else. He looked like a king, right? We chose him. So this was probably going to be a little shocking to Jesse and to all the people there. But Samuel, he shows up to meet Jesse and to meet the people. And once again, it's not just an easy thing. When he shows up, he runs into questions. Samuel is not a nobody. He's still a functioning judge at this point. He's a pretty popular guy. And this is not his normal circuit. So when Samuel walks in, what are the people? What's their reaction? Do you guys remember? They come out, roll out the red carpet. They says they trembled. Why would they? Yeah, he shows up. This has got to be, he's going to come discipline somebody, right? He's going to come set somebody straight. And they even come out and ask him. They said, do you come in peace? And Samuel has to reassure him, yes, this is peaceful. We're going to have a sacrifice. I'm here to do this. And kind of settles everybody down, at least the elders there from this town. And he tells them, he said, there's going to be a sacrifice, and Jesse and his sons need to be here. Go get Jesse and tell him to bring his sons. Now, once again, this is only the second time this has ever happened. Would you even know to put on your good clothes to get there? You know, what's going on here? Probably don't know. So Jesse knows it's a big deal. Samuel's here, brings his sons in, and they get started. And we can go to verse 6. So as Samuel walks into the place where the feast was going to be held, he sees Jesse's oldest son, Eliab. Anybody want to describe Eliab to us? It tells us about it there. Does anybody want to take that? He's a big guy. Ugly? Doesn't say that, does it? No, he's a big, strong, healthy, well-put-together male. And he's the oldest son. He checks all the boxes, doesn't he? Surely, Samuel thinks, surely this guy is the one. He looks like a king. It was not the one that God had chosen. But he looked like a king. Verse 7 says, but the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For God sees not as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. How many lessons or sermons or Bible classes or times have you tried to teach or have been taught that lesson? Don't judge the outward appearance. How many times have you had a preacher or a Bible class teacher tell you about, well, if they come in and sit down and they're in the dark, we've all heard that lesson. How well has it stuck with us? I know I still look at the package. I do. It's important, right? I still look at the package. What's true then is true now. We judge people by appearances. Now, if we're all honest, we've probably done it today at some point, something. You know, how many of you walked to the refrigerator today and opened it up? And there's that box that we brought home the other night. Looks all right. Looks all right. But it's kind of a little bit of a gamble, isn't it? How long did it sit in that hot car before you brought it in? You know, it's a gamble, but it passes the appearance. When we go to church, and I can say this right now, I'll say it. Matt's not in here, okay? When I go to church, I want my preacher to look like a what? A preacher. Have y'all ever been to a church where the preacher got up there and he didn't look like a preacher? I don't know about this. If I go to the doctor, I want the man that's going to give me a shot to look like a doctor. I don't want him to look like anything else. I can use McDonald's for an example, or you can use whatever fast food that you like. When we go home and we watch that commercial, what's that cheeseburger look like? Oh, it looks good, doesn't it? I tell you, it's got that bun, it's juicy, vegetables are fresh. You're sitting there and pretty soon, I want a cheeseburger. I didn't before this commercial, but I do now. And then you drive down to McDonald's, you pay your money, and you get that quarter pounder, and when you open it up, it's the saddest thing you've ever looked at. I don't want a cheeseburger anymore. But the package, the way they were selling it, that was what got me in the door. Packaging is important. I mean, we could probably go through a list of all the things that we've driven to go buy. I know if you like to shop and then you go pull up to buy whatever you've been looking at and you get out and they say, well, here it is. I know if you do this in the cow business, you get disappointed more often than you are excited, because very rarely do you pull up and the deal is exactly the way it's been advertised. Samuel here was looking at the packaging. Matter of fact, how many of the sons did Jesse bring through where Samuel said, oh, this is the one? No, not that one. Well, this is the one. Not that one. Well, he looks like a king. Not that one either. To the point, eventually, Samuel says, is this everybody? He wasn't satisfied. God wasn't satisfied. Samuel would have been satisfied with the first one just because of the package. I'll tell you one more story here. When I was in school, I had a kid moved in. He was 6'6". He was 330 pounds. He was an 11th grader. As a football coach, can there be a better move-in? I can tell you, everybody in that locker room said, wow, that's a football player right there. We came in off-season to do our testing. They put him on the bench press, and here you go. Started out with 225 pounds on the side. That's kind of an intro for a lineman. Couldn't get it off the rack. Kept going down until we finally found his max. It was 135 pounds. Our smallest guys were doing that. This is the biggest man on the team. He was not a football player. But if you handed him a basketball behind the three-point line, he didn't miss. It was the craziest thing you've ever seen. But that year, our head coach goes into the big coaches meeting, and the first thing he says is, folks, I hate to tell you this, but we got a new move in. 6'6", 330 pounds. Going to play offensive line. And everybody just, oh, y'all got another one. He said, but he bench presses 135 pounds. Everybody felt a little better after that. Well, they didn't get that one, but he wasn't a football player. But the package said football player. It didn't say three-point shooter, but that's what he was. God doesn't base his judgment on superficial things. We do. Probably will before we get home tonight. Something. It's hard for us to stop that, isn't it? You can check yourself, check yourself, check yourself, and then one gets through somewhere else. It's just in our nature. But God is going to look deeper. He looks at the person's heart. This is a great example for us where the judge is teaching us how to judge. We often tell others, well, you shouldn't judge. No, you shouldn't judge in the wrong way. God has taught us how to judge righteously, not with the superficial things. So a great example for us. In John 7 and verse 24, we see this lesson taught to us again in the New Testament. So this is not just a one time in the Old Testament that we can push away. It's actually repeated to us again in John in the New Testament. In verse 24, Jesus is actually speaking to us. He says, "Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment." Righteous judgment. Well, how do we know if it's righteous judgment? God teaches us how to judge. He's shown us the way. So we have to take His lessons and apply them. Moving on in 1 Samuel in verse 8, Jesse brings in each of his sons. None are chosen by the Lord. And then in verse 11, Samuel, we see he asks, you know, is this all of them? So who was missing? David. David, the youngest, right? He's the youngest brother. He's not there. Why wasn't he there? He's with the sheep. He was there. Now, the term youngest here not only means the last one born, but according to the Hebrew scholars, it also means the least, the lesser of all the other brothers. He is the youngest. He's going to get what part of the share when the inheritance is handed out? Probably a pat on the head, right? That's probably about what he's going to get. So he is the least. We don't need him there. Somebody's got to stay and watch. How many of y'all have ever been the youngest at one point in your life? If you have, then you know. Did you ever feel like you're getting left out? Did you ever feel like the other ones weren't letting you do what everybody else was doing? What does the little guy want to do when the Sunday afternoon football game's going on? He just wants in the game. Just give me the game, you know, give me the ball so I can be in the game. I don't imagine David was any different. But I also want to go back to that question, is why didn't Jesse bring him? We know he's with the sheep, but why was he with the sheep? Why not the more responsible oldest brother, the one that looks like a king? Yeah, I mean, obviously, Samuel's here, the firstborn, the oldest, the most fit, most grown. Plug in whatever you want there. Obviously, these are the ones that we want. Not David. Now, there's more to this about David. I often thought that it's cheaper than hiring somebody. That's the way my dad used to look at things. Why would I hire him? I got two boys sitting right here, three boys sitting right here. John was off by that time. But I remember when we got a riding lawnmower. Anybody care to know when that happened? I know Wes knows. We also got satellite TV about the same time. When we went to college. That's a true story. Ride lawnmower, satellite TV showed up at our house, and we were gone. Asked my dad why, you know, what changed? He said, y'all left. I'm not going to push mow this yard. It's 3 acres. Are you crazy? Got to ride a lawnmower. So, yeah, I look at that, and I say, why didn't Jesse bring him? Maybe it was money. Maybe it was teaching him responsibility. Maybe, who knows? But it's one of the fun things to think about. We do know that he wasn't there. And we also know that when Samuel finds out that he's not there, Samuel turns into a grumpy old man real quick, doesn't he? What does he tell him? We're not even going to sit down until he gets here. Now, we're going to come back to that. But he tells us we're not even going to sit down. But let's look at David. It says, it uses a word to describe David in verse 12. The word is ruddy. We heard that word before? Esau. Red, right? Hebrew word for red. Red hair. David was different in appearance. Not just in the way he acts, and we'll get to that in just a little bit, but in his appearance, he looked different. He wasn't just little. We always talk about little boy David. He wasn't just the little guy, but he actually looked different. He did not probably look like the typical Hebrew male at that point, being ruddy, being a redhead. Maybe he was just fair-complected. Who knows? Because it doesn't actually say he was redheaded. But he was different as far as physical appearance. Maybe that's why Jesse left him. Y'all have all been somewhere where you've seen that little kid. You'll go to the baseball park, see all the other kids out here, and then you see that one, and you just go, that one is a problem. He's usually got dirt all over him, no shoes or socks on, hair's messed up, and you ask him, where's your mama? I don't know. But everybody in the park knows that one. He's the one that's into everything and everywhere. Maybe that was David. You can just tell by the way he looked. I don't know. But we know ruddy is a word that is used to describe him. He's different in the way he looks, but he's also different in the way he acted. David was put together for a young fella. We always talked about this when I was teaching school, is every now and then you'd run into a kid, 7th, 8th, 9th grade, who had it together. Like they just got it. They were self-motivated. They were organized. They took care of themselves. That's a rare thing. David was one of those guys. And he had his life in order as far as the Lord was concerned, which is kind of a strange thing for a young person. David was on it. He may have looked different, but the priorities, the things that he had devoted his time to, were definitely more mature than you would expect from a young man. Now, if we go searching the scriptures here, we're not going to find an exact reason that Jesse left David. But as I said, we do know that Samuel is not happy that he's not there. And he tells him, he says, we're not sitting down. We're not going in. We're not going to eat. Party's not starting until he's here. So go get him. Now, I often try to play this out in my head as, whoever went to go get David, you can imagine David probably a little shocked. Why am I included in this? He's probably been left out before, I would imagine. Now, once again, if you're one of the youngest, you probably know about this because you were too little to go at some point in time. Do you think David panicked? I need to go home and take a shower. I need to get my nice clothes on. Well, let's go. He had never been to an anointment of a king before. He doesn't know what's happening, so he goes. And you can imagine when he walked in the difference between David and those other brothers that had already walked through. Here's this guy who doesn't look like the typical Hebrew male. He's younger than we would expect. He's the lesser of all his brothers. And what does God tell Samuel? That's the one. That's the one. So Samuel takes out the horn of oil. David is anointed, it says, in the midst of his brothers. Now, they probably didn't know how significant this was, but they would eventually learn how big a deal this was. So David is anointed. What happens next? He becomes king. Yeah, he goes back to the sheep. Samuel goes home. Party's over. This is a lesson for us in patience. I know if I became king, I'm not waiting not a second. I got a lot of things I need to do. A lot of people I need to set straight, right? David has to wait. He has to wait to become king. Now, David's life as a shepherd was an honorable profession, but it was very lowly, a lowly profession. And now he has to sit there with the knowledge that I've been anointed to be king, but I'm still out here taking care of these sheep. I'm still the lesser of all my brothers. I don't imagine his brothers all of a sudden started kneeling down and giving him, you know, everything he wanted. I would imagine it probably got a little harder. At least it did in our house. If you got an advantage over the other brothers, then it was the ones, other ones to bring you back down, right? We had to put you in your place, make sure you know you're not the favorite. We don't want that thinking going on. So I imagine David probably had to deal with some of that. And all the while being a shepherd. So let's switch in here to the idea of David being a shepherd. Does anybody want to give me some characteristics of a shepherd? Some things that, like, if you were going to hire somebody to watch over your flocks, what would you want them to do, or at least characteristics to have?
Dependable.
You want them to be able to focus on details? Think about it. It's animal. Get a sticker in their foot. Something happens. We've got a few goats, and the only thing I really know about goats is everything kills them. Everything. And if it won't kill them, it will definitely eat them. That's about how goats go. Sheep, I figure, about the same. So dependable, want them attention to detail. Courageous. Not really a word you want to throw out to a shepherd. Courageous, but yeah.
Yeah, he was courageous. He killed a lion and a bear.
No. He kills a lion and a bear. We're going to get to that in just a little bit, but courageous. Especially at this time. We have to put ourselves at this time. Responsible. We know that being a shepherd is going to be a hard life. Think of where you are. You're outside. You're with the animals. Elements, you're going to be exposed to them. But you've got to be responsible. Like I said, paying attention to detail. An animal is hurt, you've got to care for them. It's a solitary life. Some might say it's lonely. Some of us might say it sounds fantastic. I bet you not one of those sheep talked back to him. Not one. But that could start. Y'all know anybody that talks to their animals? I'm guilty. Sometimes it's not very nice. And then sometimes if you pulled up and saw me talking to this little dog we have, you would think, that man's crazy. He thinks the dog can understand him. Sometimes that's all there is to talk to. You know? And he's not ever going to talk back to me. Ugly. He may look at me strange, but yeah, we've all been around our animals. Psalms 23, how does, if we were talking about being courageous, there's one line in the 23rd Psalm that lets you know immediately life of a shepherd. He talks about a valley, the valley of the shadow of death. Probably never thought about that in the terms of a shepherd, have you? Yeah, that valley is a scary place. Things can get you. We already know he fights a lion and a bear. So yeah, this was all part of being a shepherd. When God looked for somebody to lead his people, he wanted someone who knew how to work. He wanted somebody who, like we said, was responsible. He needed someone who was courageous. And he needed someone who could endure hardship. I don't like fishing in the rain. I don't like working in the rain. I don't like hunting in the rain. I don't want to be in the rain. But sometimes you have to. There's just not a way around it. We have enough storms here. Things get blown down. You've got to go. And if you've got chicken houses, you really know. That's when everything goes wrong, isn't it? When there's a storm happening. But we have to be able to endure. David sure was able to. And these are exactly the things that God was looking for. That's why he didn't choose a warrior. That's why he didn't choose a scholar. This is why he chose a farmer, a shepherd. This has been his job since he was little, is taking care of everything else, keeping up with them. So David was the perfect choice. He may not have looked it, but he had all the things inside that God was looking for. Oftentimes, we walk past things that we probably should have bought or tried or done to go to that big flashy sign up the road, right? When the best stuff was back here. Because we were concerned with the package. We missed the good stuff. That's why God didn't allow Samuel to just pick the one that he thought was best. God was examining the heart. You turn into chapter 17, this is what you've all been waiting for. The giant. Now, beside you, for the ones that were able to get one of these, if you weren't able to get a rock, you can use a piece of paper. These are Sharpies, so they'll bleed through, so don't let them bleed through. If you got a rock, I want you to write in just a minute. It'll all come together here in just a second. I would like you to, you're going to write something on that rock here in just a second. You didn't get one, okay. Uh-oh. I can bring you a lot more. Anybody else? Pens? When we get done, you can just leave them on the back table as we go out. Anybody else? Anybody back here? Anybody else? Good. Now, if you didn't get a rock, then you can, like I said, use a sheet of paper, write it on the side, whatever you choose to do. This was not just a way for me to get rid of rocks out of my yard, but I did get rid of rocks out of my yard. We all face giants. And that's really what this story is for us. And we'll get to David and Goliath, but what I want you to do first is to think about Goliath is kind of a symbol for us. We're going to face something, a struggle. Now, we're going to use the term giant. We're going to call it our giant. We're going to have to face a giant at some point, probably before we go to bed tonight. We all have different struggles, different temptations, different things that get us, you know, whatever it may be. And it may not be happening right at the moment. Usually it's a surprise. We're not really ready for it, but we will be faced with some sort of struggle. You may know what that struggle is right now. You may know right now this is the thing that gets me every time. I want you to write that struggle on that rock. That's your giant, okay? Now, I've just given you power. What you have in your hand, when you write that on there, that rock's going to be important. Jumping ahead on the story, what does David do with the rock when he meets Goliath? He kills him. Y'all putting this together now with your rock? I'm giving you a giant killer. Now, that rock, you may go home and throw it down. It may sit in the floorboard of your car for a month, whatever it is. But that rock is your giant killer. That's what it took for David to get rid of his giant. Now, yours is obviously not a 9-foot-tall, scary human being. I don't think. Probably something a lot smaller than that. I know mine is very small. But it gets me every time. And I have to work on it all the time. And it hasn't gone away. I've been fighting it for a while, but it's still there. We have to face a giant at some point. And that's the point we're going to make as we finish up this last half of this lesson. In verse 1 through 3, in this part of the story, the Philistines and the Israelites have assembled their armies in the Valley of Elah. One on one side, one on the other side. In between is a creek, a brook, water moving through that area. Both have camped. Both put on their armor every morning. They go out. They yell at the bad guys. The bad guys yell at the good guys. And this has been ongoing. I always wondered myself, why didn't they just fight? We could have got this story over with a lot faster. Why didn't they just fight? There is an answer to that. Who wanted to give up their position? I'm on this side of the hill. They're going to have to come down and up. I just need to get them to come over here, right? The other side's not giving up because of the same reason. Nobody really wanted to be in this fight yet, or at least not give up the best position. So these two armies have set up. They're insulting each other. They're challenging each other. But no one really wants to get in the fight. And then there's one Philistine in particular that makes himself known, be kind of hard to hide him from everybody else. His name was Goliath. And verse 4 in chapter 17, it says, then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. Anybody want to tell us exactly, in our terms today, how big that was? Yeah, he's going to be in 9'6 to 9'9, somewhere in there. How much did he weigh? Doesn't really tell us that, but I always wondered this. How much did he weigh? I mean, if you went in like today's like body structure, you're probably talking 400 to 500. If he was a lean guy, this is a big fella. 9.5 feet. Says he's been a soldier from his youth. What about his armor? 125. Now, if y'all don't know what 125 pounds feels like, I'm sure there's somebody here that's probably close to it. One of these little kids come out here. We'll get a couple of them. Just lift them. You grab you a couple of them, you'll probably get close. It's heavy. So that's just what he's wearing around. What about his spear? 15 pounds. It says, it describes it like a weaver's beam. I think like a fence post. What about his shield? Had another guy carry it. That's how big it was. So this is, I think we go through this and we read this. Whoever wrote this right here did a great job at getting the intimidation factor down just right. This is a huge human being. He knows, not only is he big, but he knows how to use his weapons. He is a soldier. And for the last 40 days, he has walked out 2 times a day, and he has insulted the Israelite army, and he has challenged. Just send one of your guys over here. Just send one. Best one you got. If I beat him, we'll be your slaves. If you beat us, I'm sure that neither side had any intention of that, but it definitely worked when this big man comes out. I picture him having this big voice. Have y'all ever talked to anybody on the phone and then you met him? Sound like you're 6'8". A little bitty guy. You know, some people have big voices. I just imagine Goliath having this big, booming voice, you know, coming out, just intimidating. But Goliath challenged everyone. Verse 11, it says that they were afraid. Now, we talked about giants in our lives. Here is the Israelite army, and this is their giant. It's Goliath. He was scary. We all have a giant or a struggle. It may be smaller, but it may affect us just like Goliath affected the Israelite army. Maybe we're afraid to deal with it. Who knows? Whatever it is, but it's our struggle. Not anybody else's. It's ours. What is giant to us may be nothing to other people. My dad was deathly afraid of snakes. His two of his sons, really, one of them for sure, didn't get that part of the genetics. I've never been afraid of them. I actively go seeking them out most of the time. But he was afraid. One day I had a bright idea that I was going to scare my dad. So we were cutting hay nice and hot. It's already a recipe for a disaster in my family. Bad moods happen when they're hot. I caught a big chicken snake. Jumped off the cutter, caught the chicken snake, and I put it in his water jug. Screwed the top on. If you shook it, it felt like there was something in there. But when you open it, there's a snake. It's funny, right? The more I thought about it, the more I realized this is going to get me killed. Danny Howard is not going to react like a normal human would when he opens this water. So I go home, I get his water jug out of the truck. He's eating lunch, and I kind of tapped on the window, and I opened his water jug, and he's watching, and I dumped that snake out. And he took the curtain. He was hiding behind the curtain. I'm outside the house. He's inside. He's still hiding behind the curtain. And then you can see the anger start. Like, you left that in my water jug. You know, I'm glad I did that, that got it out of there fast enough. But He was deathly afraid. My dad was a big man. This little old snake wouldn't hurt anybody. But it was a big problem to him. I laughed at him. That was probably not the right thing to do, making fun of someone else's giant. Each of us has our own struggle, and it's very real to us, and that's a lesson for us. When we see other people struggling with whatever it may be, their giant, it's real easy for us to giggle and to say, ah, that's nothing. It's just a snake. Not to him. That was death in his water jug. You know, it was scary. We all have ours. We have to be careful that we don't minimize someone else's giant. What if that keeps them from facing that giant? What if that just more doubt? They're already struggling. We don't want to be the stumbling block for others. And that's going to lead us to our points here. Are we done? Okay. Now, we got 5 minutes. It's okay. We're going to be just right. First thing that we learn from David here is that giants appear when you least expect them. David was gone to go see his brothers. He gets there, and here is this giant challenging the Israelite army, putting his God down. David hears Goliath's challenge, and he couldn't ignore it. Second, you're going to face giants either with faith in God or with fear. David faces them in verse 11. Y'all come on in, guys. He faces them, and even Saul, the one who looked most like a warrior and probably should have been fighting Goliath, we said he's bigger than everybody, he tries to sweeten the deal. He says, I'll give you my daughter, I'll give you wealth, just go and fight him. Out of everyone there who was the logical choice, Saul finds a way out. Verse 26, we see David, he says, who is this Philistine who taunts the living God? So that puts us to our third point. Someone is always going to try to discourage you. When you're facing your giant, we know Saul discouraged him. We know his brother discouraged him. And he and his brother, I would have been in a fight with my brother normally, because that's what brothers do, right? It tells you can't do something or you shouldn't do something, and then you get into it. And then you've forgotten what you're originally after. But we know that David says that, or we see that someone will always try to discourage us. And even Saul tries to discourage him at the end. He says, you can't do it. We have to approach our giant and face our giant with faith. Fourth, we have to prepare ourselves to face giants. Prepare yourself. We said earlier David had fought a lion and a bear. He killed them. He trusted his tools. He trusted his tools when he went to face Goliath. And that gives us confidence. So give confidence in what God has given us. David could have easily said, hey, give me a spear, give me a sword, give me something better. But he stuck with a slingshot and a stick. Same thing he fought a lion and a bear with. And he was able to defeat his giant. David was probably the only one that believed in himself. Finally, we'll close with this thought. When our giant shows up, we don't need to put it off. We need to face that giant immediately. The longer we put it off, how much does our giant grow? And pretty soon, we're facing a Goliath. Any questions or comments? There's a lot of material all crammed down into one thing. If we forgot something, we'll get it in the morning. No comments? Thank you for your time.